So, hi, I'm Ben Holmberg. I'm one of the astronomy professors here at the University of Louisville. And this is my whole talk. I'm going to talk about galaxies with Webb. And with Webb, I mean the James Webb Space Telescope, the $11 billion toy that we just got from NASA after 20 years of waiting and fixing and all that good stuff. So we're learning a lot of new things from the James Webb Space Telescope. I know that Jim talked about some of that as well. It's been an exciting year. Let's just put it that way. So I'll talk to you about what I've been doing with a couple of other astronomers, so some like 120 of my best friends, and what we've been working on. So just to give you, you know, set the stage a bit, there's two Hubbles that I'll talk about. First Hubble lived here in Louisville. He was Edwin Hubble, and we named the big telescope and put it in space for him in his honor. And so back in 1936, he came up with these Hubble tuning fork to classify fuzzy stuff that he saw in the sky. So here's how science usually works. Ooh, what's that? Two, ooh, there's more of them. And three, oh, there's more of these. And five of those. And then you just put them in like little piles, and then we'll figure out how that all sticks together, right? So we're sort of in the ooh, there's more of them phase with Webb right now. But back in Hubble's day, that was, he found, so he called those ellipticals, and then this is a tuning fork, the piano tuning fork kind of thing. So the two prongs were like, you've got disky-looking galaxies, and you've got disky-looking galaxies with a bar. And the bar part is foreshadowing. I'll be talking about that later again. And then, like all good classification systems, there's this smoldering little pile of things that you don't quite know where they go. It's like, everybody here has a shed or a bin with like a jar of screws that you don't quite know where they go if you don't want to throw them away. That's the wranglers. So I didn't quite know where to put them. I like putting them on like having real galaxies for that. And so Karen Masters used her food to make that. So with ellipticals, you kind of see that they're blobby. They're just these kind of smooth things. They look, well, depending on how you look at it, like American football, I will say American football because I'm European, so I have to distinguish between soccer, which is the sport, but football is American football, so American football balls, that's what ellipticals are, and then barred galaxies, so they have like this weird little, elongated thing in the middle, and these one spirals don't, right? So there's two different flavors of those. And then lenticular sort of sitting in the middle has a big blob, but it looks like two of those. So that's how you sort of sort things out. It's sort of like postage stamp collecting, butterfly collecting. You sort of try to figure out, they look like the same, right? So that's how you get started with science. You try to figure out what kind of categories there are. And so that's what we've been doing for the last 100 years. You go like, are you still doing this? I'm like, yeah, kind of. We're still doing this, but now we're doing this with the $11 billion space telescope. So we're doing it better. So another thing is that you notice that these things are mostly red and yellowish. So we call them red and dead. They're not doing anything at the moment. And meanwhile, these little blue text now. That was the blue text. So the spirals that you can notice, they have the outskirts of blue, right? They are forming new stars. And we know that because new stars are blue. And blue stars are hot, big, and so they live fast, die young, and they just fall very corpse. That's their life cycle, and if they're big enough, they can live only for a few thousand years. And that's very short for a star, right? If you look at Subaru's, the Seven Sisters, also known as the Pleiades. Yes, okay, so Subaru logo, bunch of stars. That's the Pleiades. The Pleiades is a little blue cluster of stars. They weren't around when the dinosaurs were here. So they're just on the scene, and basically if you see something blue, it just showed up because if you blink and look again, you're like, well, you call this time, so it's gone. So these are still making stars. They're done. And so you sort of see like already a bit of a logical progression there. Like you go like, oh, this is where they're still making stars and the ellipticals are stopped. And so we might think like, oh, there's some evolution happening. So as soon as we've ordered our little tuning fork, we go, okay, maybe are they going this way? Way, or is it some kind of exchange happening? So we did some morphological, sorry, how they and shape what they look like in the bulb. And so we look like, we know what they look like in the here and now. And so we have a lot of evidence already from Hubble that galaxies change shape over time, over really long times. But how long have they looked like this, with the spirals and the ellipticals and all that good stuff? And when did the first galaxies that we see in the here and now show up, and how long did they last? Is there actually some changes there? So we have some questions. You know, we see the ones that are close by, they look like ellipticals and spirals. Do they look like that all the time? Now, the question, of course, is that foreshadowing? The answer is maybe. So from the Hubble pictures, we assume this is the galaxies, the train wreck category. So you see two galaxies getting closer. They sort of start getting bent out of shape. They really start getting bent out of shape. They sort of mix together and then reshape themselves some more. And as you can see, there's lots of blue happening in the meantime. So I can say that in like a storyboard, like we go like phase step one, step two, step three, step four. And we sort of can estimate how long that might take. We can give it to a couple people with really good computers and say, hey, put two galaxies in there and run that whole thing in a simulation and tell us how long that lasts. And that's also what we've been doing. So that looks like this. You're always limited by how much, even if you get a really good gaming computer, rendering, if anybody renders for fun or hobby or work, rendering something like this is definitely something that turns the fan on any computer. And so it's the kind of thing like you see all the blue stars scattered around and some older yellow stars in the middle. And as you switch that on, you know, put gravity in, you put all the laws of physics in and everything moves. And then we change camera angle, right? That's the other part. You change camera angle, you go like, oh, there's another one. And so let's smash these two spirals together. What happens then? It's like, well, first thing is you see smatterings of blue stars. So new stars happen as this sort of crash happens. You see also these big tidal tails that dissipate, so suddenly they're sort of fading away. But yeah, lots of blue stars, lots of star formation, lots of new stars happening in these galaxies as they sort of rearrange themselves. I love telling my students in Astro 101 as well that as you see a crash like this, you're like, oh my gosh, there's so many stars crashing into each other. There's so much space between the stars that they fly right through each other. The crash looks like the galaxies, but they're very fluffy and there's lots of space in between. So not a single, there's a, like 300 billion in one and 300 billion in the other, and not a single one of the stars collide. Which is, anyway, so you end up with something that is pretty elliptical looking. It's yellow, it's kind of like a shapeless blob, and as we now do our camera angle around it, you do see that there's a dust lane, there's still some smattering of blue stars left, but that's how you can make an elliptical. So if I take two spiral galaxies and smash them together, that's how it can end up with an elliptical galaxy. One thing is, our own Milky Way and the Andromeda galaxy, two spiral galaxies about this size, are moving towards each other, they're about to get started to turn into an elliptical. How long does this all take? 3 billion years. So we've got a minute until, you know, the night sky starts changing. But Andromeda's on its way. And so I like this one because it links it so nicely to the picture. It's a little older. You can sort of see that the rendering is like, yeah, this is a bit Shrek 1 kind of level. You can see, because I like it because basically it's the same simulation. You either switch off the angle, or you run time a little forward and go like, oh, okay, and then, you know, now I'm changing camera angle again and match it to another Hubble picture. I really like it how you go like, oh, this is how these stages work. And as then, you know, run time forward again, see the tidal tails form, and then, that's what that one looks like, maybe a little different angle. And so figuring out what the effect is and how long this takes is a major thing that we're trying to do in astronomy. Because it's 3 or 4 billion years for this to run, you know, these are all separate. It's sort of like putting a car crash together of a whole bunch of different car crashes and go, this is our typical car crash. So, yeah, but sometimes they sort of swerved or hit a little different, so we're still figuring out what exactly happens and how fast this happens. It only it's most, also the clearest when it's two big ones. If it's a small one, big one, and the small one just sort of gets shredded, and the big one just turns it off. So we know that galaxies change shape. We know that galaxies change appearance. And while they're doing that, they're also sort of changing color, right? They're changing their... When that happens, they briefly turn very, very blue and then become redder. So back to this thing, with the hardest impression background, I might add. We definitely don't want that much light to fall on this thing that we don't want. It's usually, this is the sunshade, it's pointing toward the sun, obviously, so you can only see one side. And now there's an extra little button when you're asked for time. It's like, make sure that you don't point this in the way that Earth is going, because that's where the asteroid's coming from. You don't know. This is the plot that I sort of grew up with until I started undergrad in 1995, so like Hubble was the thing, and in that time, like Hubble was upgraded a couple of times, and so could actually see further, because it saw further in the infrared, and I love that this still set the future for such a long time, and I can now say, the future is now, like, future's yes, there we go. The future is now. I'm so very happy that this now is actually here, because we're now pushing further and further away, and I'll explain how we do that. Because the further you look, the longer that light trip gets to you. So if you look further and further and further, you're getting older and older pictures of someone. It's sort of like flipping backwards in the family picture book, right? You're going, oh my gosh, granddad had hair. I never knew, right? That kind of thing. Dad had hair in my case too. So it's the kind of thing where you flip backwards and you see like baby pictures, toddler pictures, and then, you know, earlier and earlier, see like awkward teenage years, and I'll talk about awkward teenage years of galaxies. So you can sort of see that here. Like as you look further out, you sort of like, this is the age of the universe, 200 million years, right? That's where we're sort of right in James Webb. So that's the reason that we sent James Webb up, but that's not the reason why only, if you sell an $11 billion mission, you have headline science, which is like the very first galaxies, right? So Big Bang happens, cosmic dark ages, somewhere around here, the first star switches on, that's what we want to see with James Webb, that's the banner. Does that mean you're going to ignore all these here? No, I totally want to study. So I'll talk about this bit as well. There's lots of other astrophysics that we wanted to do, but that's the battery side, like the very first stars. So the neat thing is that the redshift is a time machine. Like the further I look back, the older, the very first pictures I see, the longer that took to travel. So the earlier parts that I see, I could put in a time machine reference that was either this or that for you. I love this part, because this is a slightly older picture, and I just took it on purpose, because this is as far as we sort of pushed it right in the first few months of James Webb. Newly identified furthest galaxy available, furthest and most distant discovered. It became like a joke, right? It was like, well, just wait a few hours, and we'll have this more distant one. So this the records here are constantly being broken. So that's one of the things that we're pushing. I'll explain to you, but like, why can't you do this with Hubble? Why don't you just look longer with Hubble? Like, no, we thought about it. We looked very hard with Hubble. It's not just because it's a smaller telescope. So these are filter curves. These are have these phenomenally like well memorable names like F775W. So that's that sprinkles in my normal day-to-day conversation. And see, these are really colored pieces of glass, and they let through one particular piece of light. So I'm glad that we could just see just blue or just red or something that my eyes can't see. So I can see one color. And if I take that redshift here and I move a galaxy further and further away, so here's a bunch of pictures and all these different filters, right? So I can't see it in this one because it doesn't emit light. As I push my galaxy further and further away, all the stuff in between absorbs all the light. So it drops out of the bluer filters and bluer light. So at some point, I know that at redshift 8, I can see the last three filters that Hubble has, and then maybe a little bit in this one, and not in everything else. So I can see where that is. Like, that one must be really far away. Now, if I move that from Hubble to Webb, this is everybody who knew how to fly the shuttle is also looking at, you know, real estate from Florida to retire too. And so nobody really can go back up there and put a new camera in Hubble unless we teach a robot how. And so if you push that out and push that out and push that out, you eventually end up with where you see a little red blob that you can only see in Hubble in reddest filter and nowhere else. That's how I know it's a redshift 10. And I can't push anything any further because I don't have a filter redder than that. And for James Webb, this F-150 here is about the same as this here, and I can push it way further. So that's how the hunt is on for, like, a tiny little red thing very, very far. Maybe we can push it right back, like, redshift 11, 12, 13. And so one of my favorites are the Sears. I just keep forgetting what the acronym stands for. Astronomers are great at coming up with acronyms, but they have very little to do with the actual words that we use. So we're either terrible at naming things or the acronyms are weird. So I have that a little bit later, but the Sears collaboration, this is their fly through to the furthest galaxy that they found. And Steve Finkelstein, his daughter is called Maisie, and so why are you get your daughter interested to say, I'll name the furthest galaxy after you. So that's what he did. And fortunately, it wasn't the Spirit's little detector or smudge in the telescope. It was actually a little galaxy. So as we go through, so this is everything else. We go fly through, I think our camera angle is shifted because I'm looking at it from the side. And so we're going further and further away. We figured out where all these galaxies are using that filter technique where, you know, it drops out and with newer filters. And yeah, we are sort of jinking back and forth a little bit. So these are all the galaxies that we found in our Sears field. In the so this is one of the first things that we did with James Webb. And you can already see that there's a lot of, well, things are looking a little risky. That looks like another crash. That looks like an edge-on galaxy. But as you get further and further out, it looks wobblier and harder to say if it's a spiral or not. And then here is the tiny little red dot at redshift 13 that we named Maisie's Galaxy because it's the first one at, you know, really high redshift. So the hunt is on for little fuzzy things like this. Is that an elliptical? Is that a spiral? Can you tell? It's really very hard to say anything about it, other than it's fuzzy and it's a little bigger than a star. So we'll follow it up with photography. Like, that's the furthest galaxies aren't much to look at. They are unfortunately boring to look at because they're, you know, little bodies. But they're retrovolutions in another way. So as we look at these most distant galaxies, we start noticing that most of them sort of not look like anything that we see in the local universe. They all look like sort of these aggregates or a bunch of lumps together, really. Like, maybe they're all together, maybe this is sitting here and this is just in front of it. So we're trying to figure out what that looks like. Enticing, pretty, mysterious, yes, no idea what's going on here, but they are definitely not what we see in the local universe. So how do you get from a little, few little blobs like this to a grand design spiral or a big elliptic, right? How do you do that? How do you get from little blobby stars to what we see now? And when does that happen? So that's the part that I wanted to talk about, right? So we know what the really distant ones look like. We know that there are tiny little blobs everywhere. Well, what happens if, you know, how do we get to our Milky Way? Like, what's happening in between? And so lots of blobby things, lots of things that seem like they're sort of coming together, but also occasional, this could be a spiral, right? So you start squinting very hard at where things are looking like spirals, looking like ellipticals. And so you try to figure out how many of each kind are. So that's the trick, right? How many, when do I see an actual spiral? How many of those are there? And, you know, when do the blobs stop? I don't think the blobs ever stop. So we've seen something like this before because we saw this with the Hubble pictures. And they all look blobby. And that's not a surprise because this is ultraviolet light when it was emitted. And that is only the really big star burning. Like, all the grand spirals, all the big the structure underneath is sort of hidden because you're only seeing the star formation. So everybody looks bad under blue light, as you know, if you see the a hard blue light path. And so these actually can look much more like a spiral once you start to see the wavelengths. So we're a little cautious. The other thing that you can get is you can get pictures like this, where Omegarsis is like a cluster of galaxies in the foreground, and then you have like these things that are lensed to the background. And I just had to include this as a 10 opera. It's great to find these like arcs, and so we've been looking at clusters of galaxies, and the galaxies behind it are lensed, but they're sort of distorted. It's a distorted lens. And if anybody has finished their beer yet, you can look through the bottom of the lens at me, and then you have an idea of how good a lens, a gravitational lens, actually is. It is, you know, prescription 40, but, you know, broken, that kind of thing. And so you don't get a neat little image, you get sort of like a cracked double, triple image of the background galaxy. So it's not really great figuring out what this thing really looks like. It's, you can do it, but it is kind of tricky. I would just release this one, so it might look pretty. You've seen these kind of arcs everywhere. You can also start looking at these galaxies in front and start looking for, you know, well, this is a cluster, so it's all made of ellipticals. And you can see the typical six-pointed star that is James Webb. So if you want to figure out, like, hey, am I looking at a Hubble picture or am I looking at a James Webb picture? The quickest way to do it is to find the nearest star and count the number of spikes it has. And if it has six spikes, it has those, it's from James Webb because that has hexagonal mirrors, so that causes the six spikes. And if you look at Hubble, that's a round mirror and it has a couple of struts in the middle to keep the secondary mirror. So that has four.
What's behind it?
What's behind?
Above it on the right.
This one?
Yeah.
This is another star.
Yes.
So yeah, you see 1, 2, 3 spikes, and then the littler spikes are from the secondary mirror. So there's one mirror, second mirror, and then, you know, bounces into the big mirror, bounces off the second mirror, and then into the camera. So yeah, if it's really bright, you might see more, but if it's you can see a star somewhere. Let's see if I can see that on the last one. The next star in here. Okay, I don't have stars in there. There's no other picture. If I start flying through this again, I don't see any stars. Maybe I should put the back of the video. Okay. So, but if you want to look at it and you go like, hey, I can't tell. Because Hubble's still crooked, right? So if you see a new picture and you go like, hey, count the big stars and see how big spikes and see how many you get. So we've been happily looking at bigger fields of galaxies and starting to classify those. This is the biggest picture Hubble took of just a dark spot looking for galaxies. So we've been doing this in this field for a while, and there's a new sort of like program from the web to sort of screen a big chunk in the middle and look at those middle distance galaxies and see about half the age of the universe ago, and look what they look like. And lo and behold, I'll blow them up some, they look like they do here. So we've got our ellipticals, we've got our spirals, that's 7 billion years ago, you know, ready, made, set, that everything was starting to look like they do here. That's an elliptical galaxy. This is a two-armed spiral with a bar in there. This is a galaxy, this is another elliptical galaxy with another lensing arc around it. That's a spiral. Blow that up and it could be, you know, our next door neighbor here. So quite a number of galaxies look already like they do. So it's all happening in that first half of the universe. Clearly a lot is happening in that first bit. So that's what we're pushing at. So eyeballing it all, this is my beginning. What do you do in 2023? Well, stare at these for a lot. So we looked at the ones with disks and we looked at the ones with spheroids. And around redshift 5, we don't see them anymore. So redshift 5, like redshift 3 is already really far away, and then redshift 5 is a little further still. So it's all distant and long ago, and then even further and longer ago. And so we just had these little cutouts, and the whole team just looked at them and was like, oh, I see this, oh, I see this spirit. Back and forth, keep doing it. Just to see how many there, and like, when do these things pop up? Like, when do you see them? And also, also lots of bombs. So everything starts to look like normal galaxies of redshift 5. We should talk about how long ago that is. But let's look into some more detail. Like, do I see, you know, remember that Hubble tuning fork? There was one cohort that had a bar. Okay, not a bar like this, bar like this, right? In a bar, talking about bars, it seems appropriate. And so, let's look at that in more detail. Like, how many galaxies look like that, have that bar? That seems hard to miss, well, especially this Hubble picture of a nearby galaxy, right? It's like, that seems very obvious. It gets harder, but we also simulate, of course, bars, and so this side, as you go along, this is the best resolution I have, but it sort of gets us ready for what, a little janky there. So it starts forming a bar, oh gosh, okay. Back to actual pictures. This the supercomputer's telling us, like, okay, this is how fast we can build a bar. If you see any further than that, we're in trouble. We need a couple billion years to build a bar. And so with Hubble, we looked at those cosmos fields, and yep, there they are, the little bar galaxies. They're about, you know, redshift 0.5, so 5 billion light years, 5 billion years ago, 2 billion years ago, 6 billion years ago. But as you push this out now, it gets a little hard to figure out whether that has a little elongation, right? It starts to squint harder. Let's see if the movie works a little better here. So as you go along, you start to see this elongate. So it starts weak and then becomes a stronger thing. It's stronger, you know, it becomes longer, so it's easier to spot. So the older ones are easier to spot. The youngest ones are tiny. So it gets a little tricky to do. So I am showing my first plot. I always try to avoid too many scientific plots in a talk like this. But here's the here and now, and here's the there and long ago, and 20, 40, 60, and 80% of galaxies having a bar, and if we, of disky galaxies, right? And so, if we get to the here and now, you know, almost 60, 70% have a bar, typically. But as I push out further longer ago, we can't seem to agree initially, but if I then zoom in a little bit about this last bit, this is looking like the amount drops over the third back that I look. So at redshift 1, so still with Hubble, we're down to 10% or less as a bar. So it clearly looks like our galaxies came around like redshift 1. Not any sort of, like, if I could have look back time 5 billion years ago, 6 billion years ago, 7 billion years ago, 8 billion years ago, beyond that point, bars really must have been really rare, right? That's the prediction that we're getting from Hubble. Of course, we're going to go look for those, because if we don't find them, prediction bears out. If we do find them, excellent, we have a problem. That sounds a weird thing, but in astronomy, if you kind of get one up on the theorists, they go like, you predicted that there weren't any bars over here, and now we find them. Now you have a problem because you're getting faster. Okay, so this is the program that we did with the Cosmic Evolution Early Release Science Survey, SEERS. Definitely an acronym that we made for the acronym and not for the, that's all about the documents. So early release means, you get first dibs. This was hard to get is an understatement. I think I have a better shot at, getting something like this. This is a large group of people that put this together. The early release part is like, you get first dibs, you get first look, but with the caveat was a huge one. All the data has to become public immediately. Everybody gets to play with it, and you have to make you use the web, right? So you get to use it first. You're our guinea pig user. No pressure. The thing costs $20,000 a second to run. I had a very fun Christmas in 2020 when the web went up because, you know, I was the person who dragged the kids out of bed and go like, it's Christmas morning! The web's going to launch. So, 7 a.m., we're all in front of the telly, we watch this thing launch, And my favorite new French word was nominal, which meant everything is working as it's supposed to. If you didn't think that was going to work, it took 25 years of constant engineering to build this thing. It has 2,500 moving parts just to fold out. Mind you, I worked at the European Space Agency. The Euclid Space Telescope was allowed to have one moving part. If you're an engineer, you know that you can get the thing that's not moving to move with some WD-40. We all use that. You cannot use WD-40 in space. It freezes, evaporates, and possibly turns into flame. Who knows? It's basically a bad idea to try any WD-40 in space. So any moving part is the first thing that freezes or doesn't move or something. Engineers hate moving parts, sending moving parts into space. So you can imagine that we as astronomers go, hi, we would like to fold this telescope like a piece of origami so that it fits in the rocket, and go like, okay, fine, a couple of moving parts. How many? 2,500. Really fine. And so the whole thing folded out over 5 weeks' time, and I don't think I've actually heard my colleagues completely breathe deeply until it was very much finished, right, all the way at the end. The rocket launch was, however, so much on the ball that they didn't need any fuel to correct the orbit. And you needed the fuel to correct the orbit or to keep it in a stationary return orbit. So it had enough fuel for 5 years and a bunch of corrections. You didn't need to do the corrections, so instead of 5 years, we got 20 years of usage. Basically, we have 20 years of usage unless something breaks, which, you know, turn that around, basically it means do not break anything on the web. We will find you, kind of thing. So we're the first people to do this. And the great little great things here are where Hubble has already looked. So a couple of things you do is go, I'm not going to point it at something that nobody's looked at before. I can't do that. That's too high risk. But I'll look at something that Hubble hasn't looked at before, so I know there's some interesting stuff there. And I could make some predictions on how long I need to look to avoid bright things and stuff. And so here's the Amiri, Nearcam, and Wildfield WFSS, that is different modes. And here's the original Hubble image. These are just pictures. Part of the early release part was like, okay, you have to show every mode and setting and mirror program PCR, basically how to make the blinky light stop, every possible setting for every instrument. Like, so try everything out so people know what to expect when they're designing the next set of observations. So you're supposed to use basically all of them, preferably in tandem, and see how it all shakes out. So our colleague might make this little animation of when our data happens. So here we're taking one picture with this double camera, that's called Nearcam, and this is the spectrograph there. And so as it came in, every time it's like a new visit by James Webb, and you can see like, oh yes, we're going exactly like that. But, yeah. That last one was sort of a, we have to reschedule everything because we don't want to avoid micrometeorites and all that kind of stuff. So it's like, oh, can you do something next Tuesday? How much do you love that when that happened in the office? How much do you love that when it's like this carefully planned program? They're like, oh yeah, we need something like Tuesday. So that last one was like, okay, here. So you always end up with something, you know, that's not quite a neat picture just yet, but that's what we're about to do. Pretty decent level, I'm sure. And so, of course, we start looking at us and the Milky Way, like Bar Galaxy at Redshift, oh, 3. So, yeah. That is Constantin's paper in Nature, this is like last month. We found a far galaxy that you can only see that's in Redshift 3. So, okay, we found one. That's not a good statistical sample. That's not something to make generalize just yet. But we're finding more. And so, apparently, the universe is pretty good at getting stuff already organized into bars, spirals, ellipticals, and all that good stuff early. And so Trust me, this is the last plot. I know how many plots I have. I have zero equations, because you know equations lie too far. And then a couple of plots to show what's happening. So we have the age of the universe. So here, it's flipped. Yeah? Okay, so flip, we're in here, the here and now, and we're looking back. And so this is the age of the universe, so it's super young here. So we're looking back here. We're back in here, 13 billion years. In a year means a billion years. So we look back, the whole universe is only 2 billion years old. That's where this thing is sitting, and we find a bunch of extra ones as well. So apparently, if we can get something, if you just keep growing, this thing should actually end up like the Milky Way as range zero is here. And so we have already one large galaxy of that. Everything, spiral arms, bars, the whole thing, when the whole universe was only 2 billion years old. That's fast, right? Bars was supposed to be a recent thing. And so maybe something destroys bars, something, there's sort of a transient system effect, or maybe this was, we just found the only one in the whole field, and that was it. So the search is on to see if we're working.
How big is the field?
The field is, oh, this changes, because when we get the next one, you know, the picture does, it's 10 exposures of 3 by 3 arc seconds. So it's about 90 arc seconds. Where does that mean anything to you? Okay. In terms of the moon, it is. Take about a quarter, take it at arm's length. The whole thing is about the size of George Washington's nose. It's not terribly big. James Webb is not to make made to look at the whole sky. It's made to look at small things very well, but that doesn't mean you get to see a lot around it. The other space telescope that was launched is called Euclid, and that is to, you know, see the whole sky. It's sort of Hubble resolution, but, you know, we can definitely do this with, then we look at detail of James Webb. Webb is for two things, that goes distant galaxies and forming planets, both of which happen to be warm, small things in the infrared, so that's what we can
do. So that bar galaxy that was formed 2 billion years, do you think it's still a bar galaxy 11 billion years later?
So that's a good question. Do these things get to keep their bar, or does it dissipate over time?
Yeah.
This has been a fight for a while now, and we're hoping to settle this, right? Because I see when the first ones start. But if I look at the here, if I'm looking at this, it's the one drawback of animation. So this is the long ago. This is the here and now. If I keep adding more galaxies with more bars, then I'm making them faster than I break them. Or maybe they don't break at all and make them very slow. And that was not good, but it is kind of interesting to see where that 0 point, like where did the first one start. Because if you know how it starts, then you also maybe know how long it takes to stick around.
How would you go about distinguishing between those two?
Ha! Okay. Here's a clever trick for that. The whole thing moves, right? The bar rotates with every, but it rotates at a different speed than all the stars in the galaxy itself. If you form stars in the bar, and then the bar moves, but the stars lag behind, you can figure out how fast that bar pattern moves. And that goes right about getting that in the nearby universe. So if you know how fast the pattern moves, you can also know how fast, how massive it is, and then simulate it and say, like, hey, how long can you keep it? And you can then rotate it back and see how often you see this pattern still persisting. So you sort of see the shadow in this generation of stars at the lower end, so you can see how long it's been rotating in there. In individual galaxies, this is observationally incredibly expensive. You have to get sort of stellar populations in detail of a nearby galaxy that happens to be nice nearby, but people are working on that. Funny enough, the survey is called Timer, so just to time that, you know, bar time, so because, you know, it looks like it's almost like a physical picture. So, yeah, we're getting there. that around, Sally? Yeah. Got a good idea. We're not quite there. It'll all be interesting to see if it comes out. But yeah, so between the population studies, when they show up, and how long, how fast they rotate, we're hopefully getting announced. So bars are the thing that I like because, you know, that's a thing that you can absolutely see in spiral galaxies. It's distinguished, it's very distinct between one and the other. I assure you that was the last draft that I was going to show because I haven't made the other ones yet because I did sort of the same experiment. So bars you can see when the galaxy is nice and face hot. And you can look at the top of that, right? Then you see the bar. Does this galaxy have a bar? Who knows, right? Forget about it. We're never going to tell that. But we can say that it has a neat little stripe here in the middle. Actually, this is the photo, the poster child for how they make dark stripes in the middle. But this is, you can see that it has a dark lane of dust. And that's another thing of like, hey, a galaxy that settled into, like, all the stars are in a disk, they're rotating, they have the bar going, they have the bulge going. Dust lanes is another thing that, like, this is a sort of a signpost of an immature disk. Like, the disk has settled into its pattern. And so, hey, you can look at those and you can maybe see that little dark stripe. So that's another thing. This is what I do. I do dust a lot. And so, like, hey, you can see bars, maybe we can see dust layers. And so, because I like Hadron galaxies, this is like this scene as a you can sort of see the Huff gap in the center here. Maybe in there is a bar somewhere. And so, the fun part is, you can get involved with this because we're now feeding these images into Galaxy Zoo. So Galaxy Zoo will have a web version soon where you can help us look at galaxies, vote on what you see, and see what kind of details. Yes?
Does the dimensions of the bulge or the length of the bulge, does that tell you anything about bars or non-bar? Or?
Well, the smaller one would be called, you know, small bars and big bars, but it's a little hard to say. The big ones probably got started because they got a bit of a swing from a nearby encounter. The smaller ones can definitely just start on their own. And so it's, if you ask a theorist, like, hey, how can you build a bar like that? And he comes up with four different answers. So you sort of go, okay. But, yeah, the smaller ones seem to be self-starters, bigger ones, you might need a little help and nudge from the outside. So that might tell us that as well. But you are sensitive to the big ones, too, further. So those we can see. The small ones, they drop out. So Galaxy Zoo has that. This is the brightest part of a million galaxies. So this is what was last decade. I think this is already a decade ago. But there you go. I'm one of those people who said 20 years ago, and I go, 1990, like, no. This was the first iteration where we got digital pictures of nearby galaxies, and so people could start voting on this. And the origin story of this particular project is great, because I'm assuming most people here have heard of the band Queen, and if not, you know, this is a fun thing to go look at. Brian May is an astronomer. He stopped being an astronomer so he could be the lead guitarist for the band Queen, which is a fair trade, I think. And then basically occasionally does a little astronomy just for fun, and tweeted this out, and then essentially the army of Queen fans showed up, and we've had a very fun collaboration looking at galaxies with a whole bunch of Queen fans.
Doesn't he fund a bunch of conferences and such?
You
see him in astronomy back then.
He does whatever he likes. Fair play. We Will Rock You on a guitar with a bazillion people. You get to do whatever you want. Like, you can walk right into ESA and they go, right this way, that's fine. So one of the things that we did is that, so this is a sort of like one of the first apps, because, yeah, 2010, one of the very first apps. And so it was sort of new and like a game, and I think the first Angry Birds came out roughly the same time. So either people were playing Angry Birds or this. So those were your options. Flew away with that. And so you have these different questions like, hey, is this thing edge-on? And so if it is edge-on, then it's sort of like a special case. We're not going to ask you questions about fire alarms and bars and all that good stuff, right? So really these things sort of got shunted out of the way. And so there's a little dashed line that I'm going to show you is like, hey, is an edge on? And then basically, is there anything off? And this was just one mistake in the Galaxy City, because you think what's odd for galaxies differently than the person next to you thinks it's odd for galaxies. Nobody has a good, fixed definition of odd. Right? That's just people. And so it turns out, if you're going to say, yes, here depends on you and not the galaxy, which is that's not what we wanted. But, okay, so there's basically a catch-all question that asks, like, hey, do you see dust? So the fun thing was with this first data that I looked at, I was like, oh, yeah, you see dust line? Great. So how does it work? I'm putting in a stone-old reference here because I don't care. I'm a tenured professor, so I can put however old the beams up that nobody cares. Who here has actually seen Life of Brian at UBC Class 2? This is way more hands than I got in my 100th class. I did not get zero. I did not get zero. I was so happy. Like I will be very sad when I get zero hands. So, yes, we're all individuals, but the neat thing is, if you do the voting, and you do this voting with, like, a whole bunch of people, you get classification by correct consensus. You get, like, hey, 15 people agree that this is the Bard Galaxy. Now we know for sure. Right? It's not just me, and whether or not it has a bar depends on if I had my second cup of coffee that morning, right? It's, you don't want it to be just one person. If you do it collectively, then you have a good shot, and like, okay, we know this pretty sure, we know this pretty well. And the neat thing is, you know, instead of 5 people, we have 45 people on average looking at each picture. So we're pretty sure it has a bar, we have a pretty sure feel that it has a dust lane. So classification, doing this on nearby galaxies, nope, does not have a dust lane. Yes, that does have a dust lane. You can sort of nod along, like, grab consensus. So we can do this in the local universe. I am so keen to give this to people for the web pictures. Because this is roughly the same resolution, but now at redshift far, far away. Right? We can now do this exact experiment. Using lots of the same people, still a lot of queen friends there. So we can do it with the same crowd and look for those dust lanes. I wasn't quite sure there's a little bit. Basically, it says, fractional galaxies that has a dust lane, the only thing I want to draw to is, like, big ones have them, small ones don't. So you need a certain size to have that little stripe, to earn your stripe, so to speak. So, looking for edge-ons, of course I did that with Hubble and looked further on, basically 80% of them have one of those stripes in the edge-on. This is me, just me doing it, and that convinced me to definitely involve the galaxy zoom the next time, because I'm like, never looking at 1,200 edge-on galaxies again, especially with twice. It's so much nicer when you do this in a group. It's so much more fun. You get fun questions as well, but also it's more of a, oh, we're done already, cool, instead of, I still have 600 to go. But this was one of the things I did in 2012, like, again, like, looking back, it looks pretty constant. So that looks very interesting for what's happening here with red. Can we see more of those dust lanes? Occasionally I see one, but that's not good evidence. I want to see how many we see and how big of a galaxy that is. And so that is my next thing. We're in the middle of this. So, yeah, I'm stopping and like, can you tell us the answer? I'm like, not yet. I'm working on it. And so you'll have to come back to me in a year's time and I'm like, hey, did you actually do the thing? Or that's the plan. Like, look at Galaxy Zoo, let's do this with web, let's look at those little pictures, part of that is making sure that the representation is just right. This is actually quite tricky with web. It's a new camera. This is a whole crew that made these color pictures based on Hubble, and so that's what they're used to. And it's a different color. I don't know if anybody here is an advanced photographer, but if you do a color balance, you have to color balance these things all differently. So coming up with something that makes it look good and then also make it clear in the bright stuff and the faint stuff is a non-zero trick, because as you can see from the 6-point star. Okay, so that's what's next. Looking at these different different Hubble pictures, I always end up with conclusions because I'm a scientist, so we always put our conclusions at the last slide. I always tell my students, don't put thank you on the last slide because people read faster than you can talk. So this way they can read while somebody does a question or something. But we have lots of odd-looking things. We have a lot of look like they do locally. They grow up so fast is definitely what the dad joke would like. And then Bars is Bar Galaxy. It's the first one already in registry. We just got that out. And we're now working on more of them than we're going to work on this one. So we're getting that ready. And then especially with Galaxy Zoo. So participation from all of you. You can work on the science now, right? You can participate on... That's a question. Yes? This is fantastic. I did not say the
trickiest question.
Yes, A, I will repeat your question. And two, I will rephrase it with, I have not prompted him. Okay. A, the question was, do you have any evidence for black holes? Black holes existed 570 million years after the Big Bang. This was one of the things that came out of our Sears survey. We saw a little blip in the spectra, so we saw indirect evidence of the black hole right after everything got started. So, yes, we see black holes already. Or was it black holes?
Black hole stars, he said.
Black hole stars.
Yeah.
Stars turn into black holes.
No, he's talking about that.
So it's like, first, it's like...